Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You might go to Thailand for the temples or the beaches or the food, or you could go there for a heart bypass at 1/7 the cost of the same procedure in the United States. On the way home, you could stop off in Bulgaria for a knee replacement and finish off your world tour in Hungary, where you're fitted for a gleaming set of dental implants. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Just a few years after medical tourism became a familiar term, it is a booming business in some unlikely places, catering to foreigners who can't get equivalent care at home, either because it's too expensive or altogether unavailable where they live. As my guest has learned, there are effects not only for traveling patients and the providers who serve them, but for locals in the places that design their health systems around the needs of sick people from far away. Sasha Eisenberg is Washington correspondent for Monocle and a contributor to Bloomberg Politics. His new book is called Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. Sasha, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So wealthy people have done this for a while, right? They travel where they need to go in order to see the best doctors or go to the best hospitals. What's different about modern day medical tourism?
Right. We think of, you know, I think the classical phase of medical tourism is, you know, wealthy or privileged people, you know, members of the royal family of Jordan coming to the Mayo Clinic to see an oncologist or something. Tends to be, you know, we think of people from the developing or underdeveloped world coming to find a specialist and often sparing no expense along the way. What's happened, I think, is that we've seen the introduction of medical tourism as an option for the middle and upper middle classes across the world. And as national healthcare systems have become more and more distinctive, both through policy choices that politicians make and economic and cultural changes, you start to see these opportunities for arbitrage over national lines. And so it's no longer just people going to find specialists or people, you know, the other sort of classic example I think we think about is purely elective procedures, cosmetic work, people going to Brazil to get breast implants or going to South Korea to get facial cosmetic work. It's not just these purely elective, these sort of extreme cases of wealth or elective procedures, but people who are looking to get things that they can't get at home, either, as you suggest, because of price or because laws prohibit it, or in the case of countries like Canada or the United Kingdom, where there's a national healthcare system that does provide very good free care for its citizens, often with a waiting list. And so people who want to sort of evade the constraints of their domestic healthcare condition now find that because of air travel and the ability to move electronic records digitally, that they can often go and get that work done in a country other than their own.
You were touring a hospital and had an experience that really caused you to continue thinking about this in a deep way. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was in Bulgaria. I sort of set this book in Eastern Europe, mostly Hungary and Bulgaria, because it was one of the places where the sort of changes across national boundaries were happening so quickly because of European integration. And I ended up in a hospital in Bulgaria that had been opened by a Japanese hospital chain. They had decided that they wanted to expand internationally and had ended up settling on Sofia, Bulgaria, in part because the region had, if you go to the sort of to the south or to the east of Bulgaria, you have countries with sort of well situated among countries with sort of substandard healthcare systems in some way or another. I was walking through the orthopedics wing of this Japanese owned hospital in Bulgaria and ended up sort of passing several rooms that belonged to Libyan patients who had been sent there by the Libyan government. Or such as it is, probably actually paid for by NGOs working in Libya, people who had suffered mostly war-related knee injuries or other things with joints. And I write about early in the book locking eyes with this Libyan woman, clearly in fear as her in a hospital bed. In her husband was sort of hunched over her protectively. I didn't have anything to say to them. They didn't have anything to say to me. It was a sort of I felt a little guilty invading what was obviously a private space. But it, you know, when I it seems so counter to the image, the phrase medical tourism seems frivolous on its face. And whenever I would initially tell people I'm working on a project about medical tourism, they would think about the breast implants, or they would think about think of it in a continuum of luxury, as though you go to Club Med and you get some work done. And this really just brought home to me how much dislocation was involved. That you have this, Libyan woman in a Bulgarian hospital owned by a Japanese company making awkward eye contact with an American journalist. And I realized that this was not something that people were by and large doing from any position of privilege or advantage, but out of, in some cases desperation, but also it's a really intrepid thing to do, to leave the place where you live at a moment of great vulnerability. Us going to the doctors in our neighborhood is already a disruptive experience. And so to do that across continents, to me, I thought really, really remarkable sort of modern experience.
I've never been to Hungary, so I'll admit my knowledge of daily life there is limited. But am I correct that even those who know it well would have said it was an unlikely place to become the global capital for extensive dental work?
I think that's right. I mean, the first impression that most non-medical tourists have of Hungary is the pastries. So I guess that you could come to the conclusion that there would be a local demand for dentists due to high rates of cavities. But the story of how Hungary sort of became a dental destination is totally disconnected to that. There's this, Hungary ended up, in the early 1990s, as it shook off the communist system, ended up with like many Eastern Soviet bloc countries, a sort of rich cadre of medical professionals, because it turns out that the Soviet system, while not always very good at funding hospitals with new equipment or keeping them up to date infrastructurally, was actually very good at making sure that the labor pool was well dispersed, and that there were, you had this incredibly centralized system that assigned doctors and dentists all over Hungary. And so Hungary ends the 1980s with a large number of dentists, a very good legacy actually of Prussian medical education going back to the 19th century. And so Hungary has a lot of dentists who had been trained in the 1960s or 70s by the sort of goals of central planners in the Hungarian health ministry. If you're an oncologist who was trained in 1965, probably in 1990, your skills might be out of date, but dentistry skills move a little more slowly. And so Hungary ends up in the situation where they have a lot of dentists. They end up privatizing their entire dental system while they keep a national healthcare system for all other medical procedures. And so you have a lot of Hungarian dentists who feel the need immediately to become far more entrepreneurial, because basically everybody's paying out of pocket for dental work. And you had had, starting in the late 1980s, as Hungary opened its borders to Austria, you'd had Vienna residents who realized that they could drive 45 minutes or take an hour's train across the border, and all of a sudden, the basic dental work or ophthalmological work, you could get it at Hungarian Soviet bloc prices instead of Vienna prices. And so you had a bunch of small towns along the Hungarian, Austrian, and Slovakian borders that catered to people who are driving across the border. What happens in Hungary is that becomes accelerated about 12 years ago, when at the same time Hungary enters the EU, so anybody within Europe can travel there without a visa or need for a passport. And at the same time, you have the deregulation of European airspace. And so no longer is it that the radius to get inexpensive Hungarian dental care is a, 3-hour driving radius that covers Austria and southern Germany and northern Italy. But all of a sudden, for, £69, you can fly in a couple of hours from London or Dublin. And so all of a sudden, these Hungarian dentists who had been sort of pulling from a driving radius end up pulling from an inexpensive flying radius. And basically everybody from, Moscow to Madrid to Dublin is in the neighborhood to come for dental procedures. And so and part of the story is that the current government, Viktor Orban's government, has made a point of trying to sort of brand Hungary as a dental destination and make investments so that this becomes part of its sort of, you know, a growth sector and a position as it sort of looks outward to what its place in an integrated Europe is.
And this was helped along by a very ambitious guy named Béla Batory, who happened to be the personal dentist of the prime minister. What good did that do him?
Yeah, so, you know, in the 1990s, he happened to be one of the more entrepreneurial of these private dentists. He was well-educated. He'd gone to the University of Münster in Germany, which had a very good program in implantology. In the 1990s, as the dental system was privatized, you had some dentists who became more sort of aggressive than others. He was one of the more aggressive and was aided by the fact that his practice in the Buda neighborhood of Budapest drew a lot of sort of local business political elites, one of whom, Viktor Orban, conveniently 20 years later becomes the prime minister of the country. And Batory he would be a larger than life presence even if he weren't a dentist, but we tend to think of dentists as smaller than life, so I guess the disparity becomes even greater.
This guy's a bona fide celebrity in Hungary now.
Yeah, he's owned nightclubs. He owns sports clubs. He gets written about in the newspapers as a celebrity. And he's also the beneficiary of what is effectively a massive patronage program, as the new government has made a stated economic priority out of developing the dental tourism sector. And so there's now significant government money that's flowing to him and a firm that he controls that is trying to both organize dentists who tend to be, you know, sole practitioners. And part of the thing about dentists as opposed to hospitals or larger clinics is your average dental practice in Hungary or pretty much anywhere is, you know, they count them by chairs. But you talk to a dentist and they say, we have 2 chairs, we have 4 chairs, we have 6 chairs. We have a couple of dentists, we have 2 dental hygienists, we have somebody who answers the phone. These are small businesses that tend to be, you know, incredibly poor at marketing. They've usually been passive recipients of inbound traffic, but not terribly good at facing the world. And so part of what he's trying to do is network them so that they can market themselves together. And so a lot of what you've seen is that the most successful of these dentists, like Batory, have done some of the work of basically a travel agent packaging a trip. So, you know, people tend to come not for a cleaning or a couple of cavities, but larger pre-planned procedures. So a lot of implants, crowns, bridge work. And so these are things that you'd come for 4 or 5 or 6 days. You'd need time to recuperate before you fly back. And so, you know, they would, on the trip itself, they would package it so that a driver. I mean, you show up at the airport in Budapest, and you walk out into the baggage claim, and the chauffeur's holding signs, most likely have the name something clinic on it with the name of the passenger they're there to pick up, not necessarily the name of a resort or a trade conference. And so, you know, you door to door pickup, folding in hotel costs, and then Batory was one of the most aggressive at realizing that one of the difficulties at getting especially English dental patients to come was that they didn't want to fly multiple times to get screened and then post-treatment. So he opened up an office in London and once a month would spend a day or two in London seeing patients and giving them a free checkup and inviting them to Budapest.
My guest is Sasha Eisenberg, Washington correspondent for Monocle and a contributor to Bloomberg Politics. His new book is called Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Monocle Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg, who's also a contributor to Bloomberg Politics. His new book is called Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Sasha, how does the quality of care compare for people who are coming from a place like England where I guess socialized medicine does not cover dental care? Is that the problem?
That's right. And even for procedures that are covered, so, you know, there are a lot of Brits who go to Poland for orthopedic work. That is something that is covered by NHS, but you go in and they tell you it's 9 months to get an appointment for knee surgery. And so you realize that you can pay out of pocket probably at, you know, 30 or 40% of what it would cost to pay cash in Liverpool or Manchester, wherever you live, and you can get an appointment next Tuesday in Warsaw, and next thing you know, you're on Ryanair. So, you know, in that case, it's you know, almost always people are paying cash. That's the one thing. Regardless of, there have been some changes in Europe, within Europe on this, but by and large, once people start traveling, they, you know, their usual national health insurance or their private insurance often no longer applies, and often whatever legal protections come along with it. And so there is no real consistent quality of care, and there's no, you know, we rely so much. I mean, so much of the reason that healthcare costs what it does is we have very localized regulatory systems, and they serve a number of functions, but one of them is ostensibly the safety of patients. And so, you know, in the United States, we see doctors getting licensed at the state level. You know, once you start moving outside of your jurisdiction, it becomes very hard to figure out whether that orthopedist in Warsaw is good, or what you would even compare that to. And so it's very much a sort of, you know, buyer beware environment, and there's not a sort of centralized source of information for people to assess. And when things go wrong, you know, if your normal recourse here would be to file a malpractice suit or bring some other claim or try to have somebody's license challenged, often you're out of luck.
So if I were a knee surgeon in Sofia or a dentist in Budapest and I had the option to make more money serving foreigners, I suppose that's what I would prefer to do. Is it harder for locals to get care in places that now specialize in medical tourism?
Yeah, I mean, although surprisingly, various country by country, what was surprising to me is that in many places, such as Hungary, there's excess capacity because of the government program. So, you know, the way that the Hungarian system works is that they will, that the health ministry will reimburse hospitals or clinics for a certain number of a given procedure a year. So we will do 1,000 knee surgeries. Once they get up to 1,000 knee surgeries, they can't do any more and get compensated by the government for it. It's all they're budgeted for. And so the scarcity is often means that there are unused beds, mm-hmm. and there's capacity that isn't being filled. And so in some of these cases, I spent some time with the head of cardiology at Semmelweis University, which is the most prestigious medical faculty in Hungary, in Budapest. And he is actively promoting his hospital for foreign cardiology patients, many of them coming from the Caucasus, to former Soviet republics or other parts of southeastern Europe. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Historically, the sort of Hungarian elite would go to Germany or Austria when they needed a major heart procedure. Now, as you sort of go down the ladder of sophistication, if you're in Slovenia, you might not actually have a local hospital that does certain advanced cardiac procedures. And so now you're relying on going to Budapest for them. That revenue, whether it's coming from wealthy individuals or, in the case of, I think, Montenegro, the national health insurer pays Semmelweis University to send people there that they can't get for procedures they can't get in Montenegrin hospitals. That money is the difference in funding for new equipment, for training, for sending his doctors to conferences. And, you know, so you talk to Hungarian policymakers, one of the big challenges they have is what they call the brain drain, that, you know, that good Hungarian doctors, especially specialists, almost invariably would want to go to the United States where they can make a lot more money. The chair of the Semmelweis University Cardiology Department was in the running to be the dean of the most prestigious medical school in this country. He's the chief medical advisor to the National Sports Federation. Basically, he's the national soccer team's doctor. He makes $3,500 a year. $3,500 a month. He makes $3,500 a month. This is, you know, one of the most prestigious, successful doctors in the country. If he moved to New York or Los Angeles or Dallas, we can only imagine what he would make. And so you look at countries, and there is a scarcity issue about local patients not having access, but also the revenue that comes in is essential to creating the infrastructure and the culture where good local doctors want to continue to work. And so there's this constant balancing act between, in developing countries, between taking that revenue and making it useful for local populations and making sure that that revenue motive doesn't leave you in a position where, because at any given moment, you'd always want to serve a foreign patient paying cash than a local patient either getting reimbursed by an insurance company or being subsidized at a lower rate by the government.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Larry is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I have a question about intraocular lenses. There is a lens that's approved in Europe called a Symphony, S-Y-F-O-N-Y. It's not available here. The FDA is dragging its feet. I was wondering if the guest knew anything about this and had recommendations as to which country or place I might go to get it.
I don't know about the particular lens, but generally this is the other big area of, you know, when you put aside cost and the kind of the weighting issue, the other big type of arbitrage that exists for individual consumers is sort of policy-based. Certain procedures, products, not being available for use in one country. You know, that we hear a lot about Americans who will go to Canada for pharmaceuticals because the intellectual property laws make them cheaper. We've heard a lot about Americans who will go to Mexico for various types of procedures, usually experimental therapies that haven't yet been approved by the FDA for use in the United States. And so versions of that play out all over the world. And so there are sort of opportunities and also the risk that comes along with that. I mean, there's a reason that the FDA exists. And it's, you know, it's up to individual citizens as to whether they want to, you know, take that recommendation as determinative. You know, and then there are also things that are driven by sort of cultural or sort of social reasons. I spent a bit of time in also in Sofia in Bulgaria in a maternity hospital, they, you know, have a decent business of delivering Bulgarian children to Bulgarian parents. But one thing that they do is a lot of in vitro fertilization work for primarily Italian and Turkish couples who come because for religious reasons, obviously very different religious justifications in Italy and Turkey for this. But they have both of those countries have incredibly restrictive laws on in vitro fertilization. And basically among them, you have to be married to have any sort of assisted reproduction. And so if, you know, again, if you're a couple in Istanbul or in Milan and you are not able to qualify under the law for a legal IVF procedure, you look someplace where you can get it done. It's not necessarily economically advantageous, but Sofia's convenient and you can go. And that starts to look a little bit like what the environment for abortion looked like before Roe v. Wade in the United States, where we had an incredibly disparate patchwork of laws, and women or couples were often forced to cross state lines just because there were huge disparities in terms of what was legally available in one place to the next.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because it seems that abortion is going to be something domestically that will be a source of medical tourism, simply because there aren't facilities in a lot of parts of the country now.
I think that's right. And, you know, that is the place where, you know, classically we before Roe, we saw the biggest disparity in available medical procedures, and had a very lumpy sort of map in terms of what was available where, and we're starting to see, Texas is obviously a prime example of this, a place where state level laws can force people to have to travel for care. And I think that a lot of the one of the, you look at medical tourism around the world, and when you start to think systematically about what types of procedures lend themselves to medical tourism, it tends to be pre-planned, non-urgent procedures, obviously, where people are in a condition where they can travel shortly before and shortly after, and usually things that can be done on one go. Anything. If you need to keep on seeing a doctor every week to check on your knee, it doesn't make a lot of sense to be traveling halfway around the world every time you need to do that. So abortion's not entirely ideal in that it's not a pre-planned, part of things that allows people to, that allow consumers to kind of intelligently weigh their options for medical tourism is the idea that, I get my knee done now, I can get it done in 2 months, I can get it done in 4 months, I can look around and arrange a trip. And people tend to be tend to need a window to make this work optimally for them. And abortion, obviously tends to come about under a greater sense of exigency. So I think that we are likely to see people traveling a lot for abortion services as state laws change. That said, I think it'll be in certain ways an exception to the types of international medical tourism that we see.
Separate from the delays that might be associated with FDA approval of medical devices or particular medications, there are certain medical goods that are waitlisted in the United States. Donor organs are a good example, and people who need them are put on a waitlist that is ranked according to different things, and it makes good sense unless you or somebody you really care about is on that list, and then you just want the organ as soon as possible. Are there places that specialize in, selling effectively kidneys or corneas or things that you would have to wait for if you stayed put?
Yeah, and this is, I think, the unquestionably, all of this has ethical dimensions, but I think this is the place where the ethical questions are sort of the most salient, in part because everything I've talked about thus far is you're traveling for a service. And so mm-hmm. the service is very much grounded in place. There's often a lot of infrastructure around it. When you travel for an implant, there is a service attached, but really you're traveling for a good. And the notion of scarcity there is far more dire. And I think when people look at traveling for organ transplants or the black market in organ, I mean, some places it's legal, in some places it's not. There you really do have a limited commodity, and I think a greater sense that foreigners are taking something from a local community because they can afford it than you do in the sort of more complex world of services. And, increasingly national laws are being written to prohibit that, which is why more often than not we talk about the black market in organs, because there's not actually a white market for them. But this is really the trickiest place. I think often people, when they think about medical tourism, often reflexively go to the idea of, oh, well, wealthy foreigners are going to come in and get things that the locals can't have. Often it ends up being the opposite, which is that you look at underdeveloped or developing countries, and you have the local elite that leaves the country to get sophisticated services, and you get a kind of cycle of underinvestment and political inattention. Nigeria is an example of a country with a obviously great disparity between the rich or well connected and the poor. And so if you're rich in Nigeria and you need anything, you leave the country for it. Certainly, any delicate medical procedure. And so the problem there isn't so much that foreigners are coming in necessarily to take advantage of medical goods or services, but it's that anybody with means in Nigeria will be looking to go abroad when they need to. And, there are a million reasons why we're not seeing better government services in Nigeria, but one of them is that any constituency for better medical care in Nigeria is kind of gone because the wealthy and politically powerful don't rely on the local healthcare system. And so I think that's, you know, one of the areas where, there is a real tension between the sort of local population and foreigners fighting over the same sort of pool of services.
Is competition having any effect on prices in countries that lose patients to medical tourism, where the services might be available, but they are just much more expensive than what people might travel for?
By and large, no, because it tends to be, at least from what I've seen, that at least in, you know, so much of medical pricing is not really driven by the market, but because of the nature of national regulations that are placed upon it. You know, we obviously see this in the United States that you know, nobody really is paying market price for anything, and if you and so it tends to be that political decisions are determining pricing far more than supply and demand. But even so, almost invariably, you have two separate parallel healthcare economies. You have a local economy where very few people are paying out of pocket for basic procedures, at least in the developed world, where either private insurers or the government is reimbursing a provider for delivering a service. Or you have foreigners who are coming and paying entirely out of pocket. And so you have a massive pricing disparity between the two off the bat. And so it becomes very hard to see the interplay of pricing between the local population and the foreign population, because they're effectively paying with two different currencies.
My guest is journalist Sasha Eisenberg, Washington correspondent for Monocle and a contributor to Bloomberg Politics. His new book is called Outpatients: The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. We'll take more of your calls and emails after the break. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Monocle Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg, author of Outpatients: The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. We have an email here from V, who says, I had extensive plastic surgery over 10 years ago in Thailand. Having worked in a large U.S. teaching hospital for many years, I was well familiar with standards of care. My experience was wonderful. The equipment may not have been the latest, but was certainly appropriate and relatively modern. Nursing and patient care was excellent, not rushed as in the U.S. I went to Thailand not only for the cost, but also for the quality, as this surgeon had an excellent reputation and results. I saved over $50,000 compared to U.S. prices and have been completely satisfied. Did you hear a lot of stories like that as you were doing your reporting, Sasha?
Yeah. You know, I mean, that there are, the thing that's hard to tell, there are horror stories too.
Yeah.
And it is hard, you know, statistics in this area are somewhere between non-existent and atrocious. And so it's very difficult to tell, first of all, whether incidences of things gone wrong are higher than they are in any, you know, medical environment, and whether the horror stories are any worse than you would find typically, because things go wrong in medical environments. They tend to be overlaid once things start to go wrong. Then you start to get an overlay of cultural misunderstanding, of language barriers, of inability to, you know, get recourse. And so I'm really glad that the writer found everything went well. You know, it tends to be that you know, good medical institutions in Bangkok are pretty good, and so, you know, they're and a lot of things go wrong in hospitals in Dallas. And so I think people have to be reasonable about their expectations, but they also have to recognize that, you know, we have, when things start to go wrong or you have uncertainties, going down to make an appointment with you know, the doctor who treated you and going to see them on Tuesday so that they can look over what happened again or prescribe you some new medication to deal with something that's acting up doesn't necessarily exist the same way. And local doctors tend to be incredibly resentful of patients who take their business overseas. And so, you know, I think one of the areas where people can find ongoing problems is or ongoing issues is that you go and you get care somewhere else and your local doctor isn't necessarily inclined to help guide you through that decision-making procedure or sort of fill in the gaps around it because you've basically taken the most lucrative part of your business elsewhere. And so, you know, I think that part of, you know, the person who wrote that message said that they work in a teaching hospital. You need to be, I think often knowledgeable or willing to become knowledgeable in addition to being intrepid and a little courageous to do this because the medical stuff you're relying on a professional, but often a lot of the rest of it, it's a very do it yourself. There are medical tourism facilitators who play some sort of role in between a travel agent and a sort of concierge. But if you're doing this to save money, often you don't really want to give a large percentage of it to somebody to book your airline ticket and facilitate things. And so often people who do this are reliant, you know, need some of their own sort of guidance on decision making about where to go and how to navigate what is already a very difficult world for any, you know, non-medical professional to navigate.
Let's go back to the example you gave earlier of a Japanese hospital company in Bulgaria providing knee surgery for Libyan patients. That's a lot of cultures there. What are these facilities, these providers that are specializing in patients from overseas doing to make people, you know, comfortable? There may be expectations in one country about how you're treated when you're sick, what you're fed, what language is spoken to you that vary, you know, broadly.
Yeah, and not a whole lot is the sort of sense I got. You know, English remains the sort of lingua franca in hospitals where the two parties don't share another language. That said, that, you know, the Bulgarian doctors speaking to the Arabic speaking Libyans in English are not getting terribly well. They did have translators. I think made some accommodations for religious observance within the hospital, but by and large, I don't see at the at this level a lot of cultural adjustments. And, you know, I mean, I think on the, you know, you do see sort of interpreters and translators, you do see people putting out materials in multiple languages. You do see the availability of, you know, getting a halal meal someplace. That stuff's actually fairly easy, which is why like airlines can do it. The stuff that's really difficult and can't be easily sort of categorized is all the sort of bedside manner stuff that comes along with cultures, the expectations of how doctors and nurses and patients and non-medical staff at hospitals interact with patients. And I had this the scene I told you about, the Libyan woman with her husband there. I had this immediate sense of her door was open and I was getting a tour from a hospital administrator who was showing me the ward, and he was taking me through and he wanted to show me the rooms. I sort of poked my head in, and her head wasn't covered. I had no idea what her level of religious observance was, or I presume she was Muslim. I had no idea what expectation of, but she was clearly at a vulnerable moment, not dressed to be seen with a you know, in the company of a man who was
not a relative,
her husband,
right?
Let alone a Jewish guy from New York showing up in her hospital room. There's a lot of sort of, you know, ambient space for misunderstanding or discomfort that I don't even think you could begin to put in a sort of training manual for staff, even if it was your intent to sort of make foreign patients feel at home. And so I think that is, this Libyan woman was, she had not been staying up late at night Googling, best knee surgery hospital, Eastern Europe, and settled on this one. She had been shuttled there by decision makers far beyond her and didn't have a choice, I presume, of getting anything like this surgery at home. People are doing this from some position of choice, have the ability to do some research, but by and large, I think you have to expect that you're going to be thrust into situations that are well beyond your comfort zone, and no hospital has been terribly good at preparing for that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. One of the side benefits that I found of medical tourism was we were traveling in Thailand, and my wife had an accident and broke her ankle in two places. And the infrastructure on a small island in Thailand, the hospital was phenomenal. They are there strictly for medical tourism. They exist for that, this hospital does. But the care received and the quality of care would not be something you would have associated with this island, except for the fact that they've invested heavily in the medical facilities, be it the doctor, the operation room, the equipment, and the supplemental care of the nurses. And, of course, nobody spoke English at this particular facility, not knowing exactly, how good the equipment was that they were putting in. She had to have screws and some other things put into her. Once you get home and you breathe that sigh of relief, and when you find out that they use the same manufacturer.
Well, what do you think about all that, Sasha?
I mean, the question there, I'm glad that worked out for them. The question, I think, is to what extent locals who have an accident there benefit from that infrastructure. The hope would be that it's not just one facility on one island, but that you start to have that the money that comes in from foreign patients, as I assume the caller did, is going to support the development equipment and training and access to tools that will broadly improve the quality of Thai medical care. I mean, I think that if without being too utopian about this, I think that the hope should not just be that first world travelers who end up in accidents in second or third world countries can get by as they would at home, or just that people who live in the first world and can pay have their choice of the world's healthcare. If there is a disbursement of risk of revenue that no longer kind of medical wealth has to be self-perpetuating because you spend your dollars or your employer's dollars or your government's dollars or your insurer's dollars in the wealthy city in which you live, I think the hope would be that broadly raises standards of care, broadly raises expectations, and that, you would hope that, eventually the downstream benefits to a Thai man or woman who ends up in such an accident will all redound to their benefit. I think that, I think that takes a while in places, but I saw hints of it in Eastern Europe where the local infrastructure does start to benefit locals. If anything, just sparing them the need to have to travel. There are a lot of people who don't want to have to travel for care, and there are a lot of types of medical procedures where you can't. And so I think, hopefully, that all of this sort of, in people who are stuck in place in their need for healthcare where they live will benefit as well.
But you do have some concerns that medical tourism can magnify existing inequalities between the haves and the have-nots.
I think that, yes. I think that there are governments governments make decisions about healthcare provision, basically trading off between cost and access. the availability of specialists. You know, in our country, we have decided that access and quality of specialists is above all, and coverage and costs are not great, you know, societal priorities. Other countries have gone entirely the other way. They think that cost and individual access to care is really high, and they're willing to trade off that specialists don't want to be in that environment because they can't get paid for their specialties. You know, those are decisions that politicians have made. And so, you know, you do have disparities because of those political decisions, and medical tourism doesn't fix them. Yeah, and if anything, medical tourism, as you say, sort of magnifies them. The bigger, you know, the sort of Nigerian example I cited earlier, I think, is the sort of bigger disparity that there are countries which need investment and they need political attention to make major improvements in their medical infrastructure, and that stuff has to happen locally. And there is the potential that if people can go anywhere, you know, this is a version of the sort of argument against school vouchers to private schools, which is if all the quote unquote, you know, good parents take their kids to private schools, then who's going to be left in the public school system to demand a quality education? I think you could start to see a version of that internationally, and I think that would really magnify the disparities from country to country in ways that would be really problematic and hard to sort of walk back from.
Based on your reporting, is there a country outside the United States that you think is getting this right in terms of providing care to all comers?
I was really interested in what the European Union is doing in Brussels to try to get make sure that people within the European Union are able to carry some of their benefits from country to country. The amazing thing in Europe right now is you can, you know, go from France to Belgium and they share now a common currency, a common regulatory state, common foreign service and foreign policy, common diplomatic corps, common military increasingly. And yet the French and Belgian medical systems are entirely incompatible. What the European Union has done through a series of regulations, far more modest than some people wanted, but is they have determined that, first of all, countries cannot, within the European Union, cannot discriminate in pricing. So you cannot charge foreigners different prices than you would charge locals, and that citizens of the European Union have to be reimbursed by their home providers, whether it's a government or a private insurer, for treatments that they get overseas at the same rate that they would get when they travel. And I think that some version of international cooperation like that across countries, where people can take their benefits with them and can have some sort of governmental accountability and oversight that they're not in a no man's land once they cross a border for medical care, mm-hmm. is the type of thing we need to move to sort of get rid of those disparities.
Sasha Eisenberg's new book is called Outpatients: The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. Sasha, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Appreciate it, Chris. It was fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phone from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.